Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Knowledge about medical genetics is really exploding, and along with that knowledge is increasingly knowledge about perhaps ways to intervene in genetic disease. We've decided today to try to help our listeners understand some of this new information and, more importantly, hopefully, how to get more information as we talk with an Anchorage certified genetic counselor, Anke Kelly. She practices and provides pediatric and prenatal counseling, genetic counseling at a couple of locations here in Anchorage. If you have questions or comments during today's program, here are a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And you want to spell out line one to get it to us. We'll be here for the next hour, and it's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Ms. Kelly, thanks for taking the time to be with us. This is a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with some basic information. This is a complex bit of information, and I want to also remind our listeners, if you go to alaskapublic.org and the Line 1 website there, or link there, there are a couple of references, including some very short videos helping you understand genetics. It's, if I was just hearing genetics information for the first time, we're going to have a lot of words you may not be familiar with, and we're going to go through some of those definitions, but to really maybe get a better understanding of the complexity of where genetics is, we've given you a couple of links on our website at alaskapublic.org. So let's start defining some terms, and I guess there's no better place in genetics than to start with what the chromosome is. What's a chromosome?
So a lot of you might remember from high school biology class that the picture of the human chromosomes that you can visualize under the microscope, and it's that picture of the packages that hold the genetic material that have that stripy pattern. So black and white striped chromosomes, they come in pairs. There are 46 in total for humans, 23 pairs. The last pair is the sex chromosomes that determines the gender of an individual. So I believe that most of you probably remember this picture, and that is what the human chromosomes look like. And the analysis that analyzes these chromosomes is called karyotyping. So basically looking at the chromosomes, looking at the number, how many there are. For example, if you ever had your child karyotyped, you probably were explained in the report that the child had the normal number of chromosomes, or maybe an extra or missing chromosome. And sometimes deletions or duplications, so extra or missing genetic material, can be visualized on karyotyping as long as it is big enough to show up on that picture. So karyotyping, or the analysis of chromosomes, is really limited to what you can see with the naked eye under a microscope. So it is not a genetic test that can analyze for all genetic issues.
So in a sense, it's a very coarse test compared to what we can do now. You don't see individual genes.
That's correct, yeah.
And we now know we can do that, and that it just to make sure again, when we do a karyotype, we see the number, and that can be very helpful with mm-hmm. certain diseases, where you see the number and perhaps duplications or multiple extra copies or deletions of the physical structure of the chromosomes is what a karyotype does in a
mm-hmm.
sense.
That's correct. So, for example, if you want to rule out Down syndrome or Turner syndrome or Klinefelter syndrome, so these are all chromosomal conditions where an affected individual would have extra or missing chromosomes. Then ordering a karyotype analysis would be fully sufficient to rule out or rule in a diagnosis. However, it's not always a test that can evaluate all genetic issues, and often there are further tests necessary depending on how complex the medical history or of a child may be.
All right, so let's dive down into those chromosomes a little deeper. What's a chromosome made of?
So a chromosome is made of the genes, the genetic material. So you can basically think of a chromosome as a packaging that holds the genes. And the chromosomes are only visible under the microscope when they are coiled up. They're basically condensed. This is not usually the state they're in during a normal cell cycle. So basically the chromosomes or the genetic material is present in almost every cell of the body. And the cells go through cell cycles where they make divisions, they copy genetic material and divide into daughter cells and pass on a genetic material to the daughter cells. And therefore, it's necessary that the genetic material be sometimes condensed and sometimes relaxed. And in order to see the genetic material, the genes need to be condensed or in that supercoiled state that then we call chromosomes. But there's a lot of other testing that can be done on the genetic material. So not everything depends on having the chromosomes visible in that supercoiled state.
All right. So it's important, just because of where we may go with this program, to understand that for the vast majority of the cells in our body, we're constantly cells are in a state of dying and decaying, and they're making new daughter cells, ideally exactly the same way, over and over and over again. And that gets to the fact that there's a tremendous number of billions of times we're copying DNA, which leads to some of the problems with genetics, is when you do anything a billion times, every once in a while something doesn't quite go right. But so that's an important thing to understand. All right, so just take us down to these genes a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about what's making up a gene, what else is in those chromosomes.
So a very basic idea of how to look at a gene is to just think of a gene as an instruction that makes a protein for the body. For example, one gene or an entity of genetic material, the gene will code for a protein like insulin. It is a little bit more complex than that, but I think it's just that's sufficient to just remember that genes are structures that tell the body how to make proteins. And sometimes, yes, genes interact with one another. Sometimes these protein products interact with one another. But I think the bottom line is, yeah, you have genes and they code for proteins that then have a function within the body. And, of course, there are different methods of analyzing single genes as compared to what we referred to previously, the chromosome analysis. There is ways to analyze single genes, or there are ways to analyze several genes all at once, or now, more recently, there is a way to analyze all of the coding sequences of genes. I guess I should mention that genes are made up of what we call exons and introns. And the exons are the parts in the gene that will later tell the body how to make the protein. So there is a little bit more information in between those exons. Those are called introns. They have important functions, but they are not, in the end, part of the protein that the body will work with. But that's the basic idea. You have a gene consistent of exons and introns, and most of the genetic mutations that are found and are disease associated are actually in exons. So just to give you some numbers, so about 85% of disease-causing mutations are in exons. And I think that would bring us immediately to the next issue, namely that not all genetic testing can always identify the mutations. And that's a big issue because even if a child, for example, is tested for a certain condition, sometimes we have a very strong suspicion that the child indeed has the genetic disorder, but genetic testing just can't reveal or find the mutation that might cause it. And this can be really frustrating sometimes for parents.
I want to, first let me go ahead and give the number, how to contact us again, but I want to come back and talk about the difference, some other differences between chromosomal abnormalities and these individual smaller genetic abnormalities, just to help people put some framing on that. If you have questions today, our local number 550-8433, our local number 550-8433, toll free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So if you've been paying attention and you can follow where we're going here. A chromosome has lots of genes on it, and we've got multiple sets. And a karyotype identifies the structure of that we can see of these chromosomes. So you might see deletions or multiplications of parts of chromosomes, which cause disease. It's important to understand when that happens, there are lots of genes lost or lots of genes copied. Now we're down to where we're talking about our ability to understand what's going on is we're looking at genes specifically, and there are actually parts of genes that are introns and exons. We haven't talked, there's even things called enhancers and things that cause genes to get turned on, and it gets pretty complicated. But anywhere along all these lines, we can have little mutations. And just because you have a mutation might not cause any problem, or it might be advantageous, or it might cause disease. So we now, as I hear you saying, we've got that ability to look at about 85% of the information that is causing diseases now. We have that capability, but that means 15%. We still don't have the ability to figure out for one reason or the other.
Yeah, I should add that there are some newer tests that have become available clinically now, and just thinking about pediatrics now, most medical geneticists have started offering what is called whole exome sequencing for children that are really complex and have had multiple genetic tests with negative results. So whole exome sequencing, referring to looking at the coding sequences of all of the 20,000 genes that we carry. The next step up from this actually would be whole genome sequencing, also not just looking at the coding sequences of all the genes we carry, but actually looking at the introns, those functional units in the genes that I mentioned beforehand that are not part of the end product, the protein product, mm-hmm. but are important for the functionality of the genes. So there are two newer tests now that will become more and more available in the future. So again, called whole exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing, and they are right at this moment very expensive. Some of them are only available on a research basis, and there's definitely a very lively debate over how to interpret results that come from these tests and how to really inform the parents or prepare them before their children undergo this testing, how to prepare them for possible results that they actually may not even expect.
Another thing that perhaps some listeners have heard of or aware of is that it's now fairly certain, and again, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that only a very small percentage of all that genetic, all that DNA is actually genes.
Yeah. There's a lot of genetic material that is not part of a functional gene. And it's still not very clear always what the function is. I think that research has agrees in most cases that we need that so-called filler material in the genetic material, but it's not always clear what it's for. And so more research needs to be done to figure that out.
Yeah, so it's possible that some of the reason we can't figure out all the diseases is there's still some parts of our DNA that are acting in ways we've yet to completely understand or at least be able to test for.
Yeah, that's correct. So I think if you take in all of these perspectives and what might come out of research in the future, I think that in a certain way we're very far from the end of the story here. And even the genetic testing that gets offered right now has its limitations and its headaches that come with it.
One of the things I heard this morning, and this is just a comment, and you don't have to answer it unless you want to just tell me I'm all wet, is we often hear also that we have almost entirely the same genome as, say, a monkey. And people say, well, how come we look so different and so forth? And part of the reason for that is there is, to me, completely, we still don't understand is, yes, we have exactly the same genes to a 99% certainty, but these genes get turned on and off and regulated in very different ways, which may include some of this non-gene DNA and the way it works. And so it is true that our genes are very similar, and that's why we can do human studies on mice and so forth, because they have the same genes. It's just we look different because of what regulates when they turn on and off, and that regulation goes on in our own body. And we have the same genes in our retina as we have in our skin tissue. It's just at different times for reasons that are fascinating to me, but we don't quite understand is what turns those on, what instructs genes to get turned on and off in certain times.
Yeah, so, and there are definitely some known human genetic conditions that fall along those lines. So, for example, the body has a mechanism of knowing whether a particular chromosome or gene came from the mother or the father. And for in certain areas of certain chromosomes or genes, it becomes important whether the gene inherited came from mom or dad. And genes that are turned off are methylated, meaning there is a molecular group attached to the gene at most often at the beginning of the gene to basically block the machinery of the cell to translate the gene into a protein. So it's basically a gene attached that has a stop sign attached to it, and so it doesn't make a protein product, because sometimes it's important to only have a protein product from either the mother's gene copy or the father's gene copy. For most genes, it doesn't matter. For most genes, both gene copies make protein products, but for some genes, it's important that only one is active and the other is inactive. And sometimes that's where genetic disease comes in, too, when there are mistakes being made at that level of methylation, or if the body misses a part of the maternal or paternal copy of a gene, it can lead to health problems.
So you've kind of opened up this one last area, hopefully, maybe it's the last area I want to ask about, but it's interesting is that we now know that these genes that we have, and let's say you got an identical twin, but if they're raised in different areas, different environments, and we can structure those environments in ways we want, we can actually control which genes get turned on and off by environmental influences, and that's a whole science of called epigenetics, and it's very clear. Now, if you have somebody with asthma who is in certain parts of the world and another one in another part of the world, we can actually see different proteins working at different amounts, and we can actually now with technology see which genes are actually turned on and off. So our DNA, our genes are also responsive in ways we're just beginning to understand to environmental influences, which was a big whoa not too long ago in research. Gets very complicated in a big hurry.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
All right, we have a caller or an email that's come in and says, please discuss reputable companies that can do genetic tests for those of us who wish to find out if we possess certain genes for specific conditions. I am not interested in companies, the writer says, that only give me a percentage of likelihood of developing a condition. I want to know what companies will tell me if I possess a gene. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can give an answer that will be satisfactory to the listener, but I will try. So there is a difference between clinical genetic testing and direct-to-consumer genetic testing. And typically what happens is the clinical genetic testing is ordered when a patient or individual presents to a doctor's office with a specific concern for a specific genetic condition. And then the geneticist and the team will help try to figure out what is the best genetic test to order for that person. Basically, the idea is always to order genetic testing as specifically as possible. The testing that really targets the whole exome or whole genome is only meant for patients where the patient already had a huge genetic workup with negative testing so far. And that's kind of like a last step right now to in an effort to try and find an underlying genetic mutation for that person. So if you try to find out about your genetic material and if you may be predisposed to certain genetic conditions, yes, you could certainly try and find direct-to-consumer genetic testing laboratories that offer, where you can basically at home spit in a sample tube and send that sample into the lab, and they will analyze certain genes and then report the result back to you. So in other words, you don't need to go see a physician to order that test. You can pay for it by credit card and you can send that sample in to the lab directly. The lab will then provide you with answers. The problem with that is that there's a huge difference in what different laboratories report on it. They may use very different technologies to analyze genes. They may not analyze certain genes at all. And if you get a normal or negative results, it may not actually mean that you're not at risk for having the condition that you were actually thinking about. So it becomes really complex. And that's why I don't think I can actually recommend one or two certain laboratories. Just simply because genetic testing is used typically with a specific condition in mind. I hope this makes sense.
Yeah, I was hoping that this kind of question would come in because what we've been talking about to date, if you really stop and think about it, is this whole issue is far, far more complex than the general public understands. And when you send in some information to a company, you do not really know what you're getting back relative to what you should or how to use that information because there's too much to know. I think these companies might be, and here you can correct me again, Anke, if you would like, but they may be great for helping us understand our ancestry and where we came from and are we related to somebody in China and so forth. But when we start getting into the medical aspects, it is not sufficient. Even allergy testing is like this. Allergy tests people have been doing by mail for a long time, and it's been very clear that there are a lot of false positives, there's a lot of false negatives. You still don't know how to interpret the test, even though it seems very simple. So these kinds of use of, I would go so far as, here's where you can tell me, I don't think people ought to be doing those things.
Yeah.
For medical diagnostic purposes.
That's correct. I think if you do want to have a little bit of fun with genetics and want to know your ancestry, yes, by all means, find one of those labs and send in a sample, find out what they, you know, what your ancestry might be made of. But if you are worried that there's a particular genetic condition that might run in your family, this is definitely not the way to go. Then I would definitely recommend to go see a physician and have him refer you to genetics or order the genetic test relevant to the disorder.
And once again, to kind of make this clear, we're still discovering genes associated with problems. So you get a test that by mail that says you don't have this gene, and next week we discover a new gene that's related to it, you could have it. Genes interact. The environment interacts with genes. So we now know you may have risk of, let's say, allergy, but if you don't have exposure to certain environmental factors, perhaps early in life, you will never develop allergy. And that's not true of all diseases, but it just, I'm trying to indicate the complexity of trying to do this without a really knowledgeable person in between when you start trying to get some information about medical genetics. Well, we've spent most of the first half of the program just talking about genetics, which I think is the most important part. And we'll spend the rest of this program talking about what genetics counselors can do for you and answering your questions. So don't hesitate to stay on and continue listening to Line 1. Remember, our local number is 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll continue our discussion on genetic counseling with Anke Kelly. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's guest is certified genetic counselor Anke Kelly. She provides pediatric and perinatal counseling here in Anchorage. You can reach us with emails during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. This program does repeat tonight on KSKA between 9 and 10. It's a recorded broadcast, so you will not be able to ask questions at that time, but you can listen again. And you can go to our archives at line1@alaskapublic.org and listen to the program that way, or actually refer listeners that you or others that you'd like to have listen to this program or prior programs. That, again, is line1@alaskapublic.org and the at alaskapublic.org, and then look for the Line 1 program in our archives. One more question. We have a caller I want to take, but I want to ask one more question about how medical genetics works. And I don't think we've maybe taken an idea of how a mutation or a change in the genetics happens and how that leads to disease necessarily. So I wrote a question down that says, give us an example of a mutation that leads to disease. How does it occur? How is it pressed on and passed on and so forth? So I'm thinking cystic fibrosis, sickle cell disease, some disease you want to tell us about. What do we know about it? How does it happen and how is it passed on?
Mm-hmm. So some genetic mutations are, or for some genetic conditions, the mutations are most often inherited from one or both parents, depending on what the actual inheritance pattern is. But there are certainly conditions where a mutation can occur de novo, or meaning new for a conceived fetus. So as Dr. Woodard was explaining earlier, our cells go through cycles of making daughter cells and copying genetic material. And sometimes in that process, mistakes can happen. And that's when a de novo mutation would occur. And if that mutation is present when a fetus is conceived, then that individual would have a de novo mutation that could cause a genetic disorder. On the flip side, there are some recessive disorders are disorders where each mom and dad carry a genetic mutation. However, they are asymptomatic, meaning they don't have any symptoms. Yet if they each pass the mutation on to the fetus, then that child would have the genetic condition. So again, there's a distinction between de novo mutations and inherited mutations. And they, at some point, each occur due to a mistake in the copying of the genetic material.
All right. Let's take a caller. Anita, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hello. I had a brother who was born in 1947 with, he had dystonia. And we were all, there were five of us born. And we were all tested in 1968 at the U of W. And at that time, they stated that it was just a one-time event and we would be fine. But subsequent to that, I've done research over the years, and it is genetic, is what I've discovered. And I'm wondering, what are the chances of that recurring again in one of my siblings, or in my children?
So I would certainly recommend if you have a primary care physician, to bring that up and have him or her refer you to genetics, because yes, certainly since that time, there is a lot more information that has come out. And as for all genetic disorders, most often we find more genes associated with a condition as time goes by, and the genetic testing has become more specific and better. So I think I would recommend a check-in with your primary care physician, or if you have a genetic counselor at hand, to check in with him and her and discuss it in more detail. And usually in genetics, we recommend a time frame of every 2 to 5 years. We estimate that we have new information on any given genetic condition. And so since your family member was tested, did you say in the 40s?
Then, well, initially, he was born in 1947. Initially, they thought he had cerebral palsy when he started developing symptoms at 2 years old.
Right.
And but it wasn't until, oh gosh, it was in the late 70s, early 80s when I found a book on it and stated that it was genetic.
Right.
Yeah, so I would certainly recommend finding a local genetic counselor or geneticist to talk about this in more detail. And before you do, make sure to gather all the medical records related to this that you can and bring it to the appointment. Medical records are really always very important to have at hand when talking about genetics.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So one of the problems that I think I hear you kind of working around is a problem like dystonia may not even have been recognized as a disease when this family was first diagnosed. It was very common early to think of all kinds of neurologic problems in infants as cerebral palsy. And much like we now know that a lot of prior children that are now diagnosed with autism had different diagnoses in the past. And also the field of genetics has exploded. So there may be books written about different kinds of dystonia, all of which have different genetics. And so that drives the next point is you're an expert on prenatal and perinatal, but there may be times where you have to really talk with a neurologically expert in genetics, and even the geneticist may refer to specific genetics. So for some of these diseases, it is just there's too much. Nobody can have all those information, although they can now. There's compendium of resources that help people get that information.
That's correct, and I always kind of want to describe genetics as like a detective field. We always try to get as many medical records for a patient as possible before an appointment, just to get the full picture. It's really important to get the full picture on a patient before even thinking about a possible genetic diagnosis or ordering genetic testing. And sometimes we refer patients on to other subspecialties because we do need more input from let's say, neurology or ophthalmology. And sometimes brain imaging becomes really important, especially with pediatric patients that have neurological issues. And because these symptoms are overlapping and hard to distinguish, and sometimes who reads these brain images, for example, the interpretation on this might vary greatly. So sometimes it really becomes necessary to refer to experts in the field and then get a second opinion and then think about further genetic testing. So it's not always as straightforward as maybe it seems. And I think this is also the source of a lot of frustration for parents and families, is that sometimes all the genetic testing that someone may have had in the family hasn't led to a conclusion or a diagnosis, and the search goes on, and it can definitely be a source of frustration too.
So here's a question that leads to somewhat similar question of what you're talking about, is that there are what are known as complex genetic diseases, diseases where we know and our certain genetics plays a role, but it is so complex and within relationships to the environment that it's difficult to give you answers. So here's the question. Thank you for your thought-provoking and informative program. Is there any evidence that alcoholism has a genetic component? It seems anecdotally that many families, including my own, have many alcoholics over many generations, and that some people who do not have a compulsion to drink. What can genetics and epigenetics tell us about this? Can science determine the triggers to gene-influenced conditions?
Actually, I do remember reading a research paper a couple months ago, and it wasn't related necessarily to alcohol addiction, but I do remember I was researching a patient and I came across a paper that was relevant to that patient, and I think it was about certain genes in a chromosomal region where our patient had a deletion. And interestingly, other research had found that some of the genes in that region are related to alcohol addiction. So absolutely, as the research goes on and we learn more about certain genes and their functions, I think there is now a little bit more knowledge in that area, and there are, I think, some genes that, or candidate genes that have been identified as being possibly responsible for causing alcohol addiction.
Yeah. I guess I would try to echo the idea, again, going back to complexity, is if you have Down syndrome, you clearly have extra copies of a whole chromosome or parts of one, and lots of extra genetic material that causes the problem. So that is very clearly easily determined, whereas some diseases like alcoholism or asthma allergies may have a genetic predisposition, but lots of environmental factors. So you might show that there is a gene that increases a protein that makes you more likely to addiction by affecting your part of your brain that likes rewards, but that doesn't explain necessarily everybody's addiction or anybody's specific addiction, or it may just need the right environmental influence. And that's only one particular gene. So certain diseases like addiction, almost everything has a genetic basis, but it gets very difficult to prove that's the single issue. Does that make sense too?
Oh, yeah. And maybe one other example that people are familiar with is cleft lip and palate. There are lots of kids born with cleft lip or palate or both. And interestingly, what I always tell patients in counseling is that it's multifactorial, that the environment also plays a role, and that not even all the genes that may cause cleft lip and or palate have been identified yet, even though it has been very extensively researched. And so sometimes we just don't have the full answer. Sometimes I can only tell patients in counseling that, for example, the chance to have another child born with cleft lip or palate is maybe 3 to 5%, but I don't have the specific answers or the specific tests to give the family a definitive answer. And I think that's the case for many of the genetic conditions that are part genetic, but maybe part due to environmental influences.
Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is genetic counselor Anki Kelly. Anki is a specialist in particularly in fetal maternal genetics and pediatric genetic issues. And if you've got questions, you can reach us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Another email that says, are genes responsible for personality?
I would probably argue yes, even though that's totally not in my area of expertise to answer this question, probably. But if you think about that, you get half of the genetic information from your mom and the other half from your dad, and that most children have traits from both mom and dad, I think it makes intuitively makes sense that yes, there's a genetic component to personality. I'm sure that if you invited a different person on this program who studies environmental influences on personality of and how personality is formed, then I'm sure that person had a different answer for you. But I do think that definitely partially our personality is formed by genetics.
And one portion of what you might say is a part of personality is what's called temperament. And temperament can be measured in newborn babies before much environmental influence. We could argue that there's been some in utero environmental influence, but this is things like intensity of reaction, regularity, persistence, and there's a number of qualities, and those have been studied over long periods of time, and since they're present at birth, suggest strongly that there's a genetic component. However, they can change, even these temperamental qualities, which would be part of your personality. Your personality is also intelligence and some other issues, but so I would say, yeah, absolutely, genetics plays a part in your personality. But again, this is a multifactorial attribute that humans have. Another question. Can you explain the relationship between genetic mutations and spontaneous abortions? Is the question from a listener.
We know that a certain percentage of miscarriages are caused by some very well-known chromosomal conditions. I think that the statistics out there mostly refers to whole chromosome issues, like, for example, fetuses that have an extra missing chromosome or a whole other set of chromosomes instead of the 23 pairs have another 23 additional chromosomes, so that would result in triploidy. And it has been very well researched that miscarriages are caused by these differences in the number of single chromosomes or a whole set of chromosomes. So that that's very well established. I'm not sure how a single gene mutations would contribute to the overall rate of miscarriages, but I can see that maybe a minor part of miscarriages could be due to single gene mutations as well.
I remember being taught years ago that, in a sense, normal babies, this was kind of the short way of remembering, normal babies are born normally, so that if someone has a lot of miscarriages, it's almost suggestive, it's nature's way to try to take care of serious genetic malfunction, and that I think we do know for a fact that most, but not all, really serious genetic abnormalities do end in miscarriage. Is that still thought to be the case?
Yeah.
That's another
way
of looking at that question.
I should probably also mention that couples who experience more than three miscarriages should see a genetic counselor or a perinatologist, simply because if miscarriages happen more often than once or twice, then there could be a predisposition for that couple that causes that to happen. And one reason I can think of would be translocation. So sometimes a parent carries a chromosomal makeup such that all the chromosomes are there and all the genetic material is there, but sometimes genetic material can switch places between two chromosomes and create what is called a translocation. And then when that is the case, it becomes more difficult for the body to divide the genetic material equally and create germ cells that have the right amount of genetic material for the fetus. And that's when we see repeated miscarriages, and that is one reason to seek some medical help to sort this out.
I've also, along the same line, heard that or understand that at a certain age, perhaps both men and women, but certainly women, it makes sense to have some genetic evaluation. Why is that? I'm referring to pregnancy. I don't think
right.
I made it clear.
Yeah. So certainly some chromosomal conditions are what we call age-related. And age-related more so refers to the mother than the father. I guess the fathers are off the hook for that one. But so you probably have heard that women who are over the age of 35 and pregnant are now called advanced maternal age. And it's because that there's really nothing magic to that age 35, but it has been kind of arbitrarily chosen by the medical community to kind of serve as a cutoff above which women are at an increased risk to have a baby with, for example, Down syndrome or two other conditions called trisomy 13 and trisomy 18. So the human body the humans are predisposed to having aberrations in certain chromosomes, and or I should mention that some chromosome abnormalities don't even let a fetus form per se. So, and then there are some conditions where an extra chromosome, like for example, chromosome 21, 13, or 18, if an extra chromosome is present, a fetus can certainly form, but there may be problems in the development for the fetus.
I'm just thinking along the line of other common reasons people might want to speak with a genetic counselor, and I guess this is somewhat similar perhaps to one of the emails that came in earlier. Certainly if you think you have or know you have a medical condition and wanted to know if it is hereditary and could be passed on to children, and what's that risk? That would be a particularly good reason to seek out a genetic counselor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The job of genetic counselors in general is to help families understand a certain condition and how it's inherited, who in the family is at risk of passing it on or having the condition. So that is all. These questions are all questions that are for the genetic counselor and the geneticist to explain and sort out. And that's exactly what genetic counselors do. We try to translate complex medical genetic information to patients so they can understand it and can use it to their advantage and help other family members understand the information.
Do genetic counselors often get involved in some of the ethical or moral considerations of understanding your disease, your risk of passing it on, and so forth, or is it pretty much limited to here are the facts, and it's up to the individual then to kind of grapple with what to do with that information?
There's some extent of psychological support that we can provide. So genetic mm-hmm. counselors receive some training in how to deal with some strong emotions and help families through the process. So I see that very often, that genetic information has often a strong impact on how people feel about that information, because it is very personal and it has a very strong emotional impact sometimes, depending on what the diagnosis may be. And sometimes, or often even, one genetic counseling appointment is not enough to sort through all of that, and that's when follow-up is really a good idea. Follow-up, for example, to bring a child back to clinic, talk about more questions, help guide the family to the right resources and things like that.
Could you perhaps ferret out a little bit better for us what happens typically in a genetic counseling appointment?
Yeah, so for example, if you're looking at a pediatric appointment, So what happens prior to an appointment is gathering medical records for the genetic counselor and doctor to look over. And then during the appointment itself, the genetic counselor typically, takes a family history to get a full picture of who in the family might be at risk or who has symptoms. And then after that, the geneticist would step in and do a physical exam on the child, basically a head-to-toe evaluation of the child, and make recommendations with regard to genetic testing. And after that part is done, then the genetic counselor would come back in and help the family understand the testing process, do the consent for genetic testing, explain how the payment of the genetic testing might work and if insurance might be covering the genetic test for the child.
Is another question, I guess, that many people may have concerns about in this day of such dramatic access of information is the genetic information that's provided to the physician and to a genetic counselor protected, and if so, in what way?
There are certain protective legal steps now. For example, health insurances are not allowed to use the knowledge of a genetic condition against the patient to obtain coverage, for example. So even if you have a genetic condition, your insurance company is not allowed to discriminate against you and kick you out of the insurance plan. However, there are some loopholes. And if you, for example, think further ahead and think about the rare chance that you might have to maybe obtain some other insurances for older age. So those kinds of, I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, but some insurances that cover you if you are no longer able to work and insurances like that.
Yeah, disability kinds of insurance.
Right.
Yeah, and life insurance.
Exactly. And They are not always bound by the same rules as health insurances. So if you are found to have a genetic condition, you might want to carefully talk to all of the insurances you have or maybe not talk to them and not let them know that you have the condition just to be on the safe side.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. Or I hadn't thought about that because usually when you do apply for insurance, you're also at some point during that for life insurance or disability, you're given the right of way for the insurance company to look at your health records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's an imperfect system right now. The health insurance part seems to be covered. It cannot be... there's no discrimination allowed, but then other insurances are not bound by the same rules yet. And I'm not sure if that's going to change rapidly or if it will ever change. So it's something to consider when also considering genetic testing.
How about does health insurance generally cover genetic counseling? And what about some of the testing that's recommended during a genetic evaluation? Is that also covered by health insurance?
So I would say typically the appointment itself is covered by insurance. However, the genetic testing itself is a completely different issue. It's also the job of a lot of genetic counselors to help patients figure this part out. So genetic counselors do call the patient's insurances and ask if the tests are covered. And it becomes really complicated because test coverage does not only depend on whether or not genetic testing is generally covered in the healthcare plan of the patient. It depends on the codes that a genetic test comes with. So these codes define what techniques are being used in the laboratory, and based on what codes you submit to the insurance company, they may approve or deny the testing. So in other words, the insurance companies have lists of codes, and they look at these codes and then make a decision of whether or not they will pay for the testing. And I have unfortunately seen that even when we explain a child's condition and explain why it's medically necessary for the child to have the test, that insurance companies have denied the testing just based on the codes by themselves.
Anki, we're really only have about 3 minutes left, and I'm thinking, what do I want to ask? And I think the last question I'd like to ask you is to help physicians. We definitely have providers who listen to this program, and we've talked about patients, but you also can help providers. What are some of the things that we should, as providers, know that we should take advantage of you about getting information on?
So, for example, for pediatricians, I would say that genetic counselors can really help guide the testing process. So, for example, if you have a child that you have a strong suspicion may have a genetic condition and you want to start some testing before sending the child to genetics, genetic counselors can certainly talk over the phone with you and help guide the testing process, or can help you figure out what other subspecialties the child should see first before being referred to genetics. That's just one example I can think of.
I know sometimes I don't know what test to ask or how sensitive or reliable the test may be, too. Can you help with that kind of information?
Yeah, absolutely. Genetic counselors can explain what the genetic testing would entail and what kind of information you can expect back from it, and what the chances that the child might actually have the suspected condition, but the genetic testing may still come back with a negative result. So, and also we typically can research the laboratories and find out what the specimen requirements are for the blood draw.
Yeah, nowadays that's often, I mean, there's so many different tests and it's just sometimes difficult. So I just need to remember myself to take advantage of you, because it's sometimes it takes hours to figure out what to order. And then sometimes I don't feel comfortable that I've ordered the right thing even after all that time. So
no, I would definitely encourage people to call.
All right. Thanks very much for taking the time. This has been fascinating for me. It's a deep, deep, deep subject. I hope it helps people understand the complexities of getting information. There's much more we can do and help people with, but we still don't have all the answers and probably never will. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks again to my guest, Anchorage Genetic Counselor Anki Kelly. If you'd like to continue the conversation on genetic counseling, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, and that's where you also find the Line 1 archives. Next week, my guest host will be Prentice Pemberton, who's doing about a once-a-month program on mental health or emotional health issues, and his guest will be an expert on conflict, and he has pointed out, his guest, that high-conflict people have four common characteristics. They often are preoccupied with blaming others. They have all-or-nothing thinking. They have a lot of unmanaged emotions and extreme behavior. So if you want to learn more about handling difficult people, please listen to Prentice as he interviews his guest, Bill Eddy, on the next program. Remember, that'll be Monday, January 26th at 2 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.